Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who's been a comrade in arms in that war for a long time is my old friend Peter Husey. He is these days the director for strategic deterrence studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. He has held salons in Washington at lunches and breakfasts, and a few dinners, I think, over the years, in which he's done enormously important work helping the rest of us understand some of the strategic and other challenges we're facing as a nation. And it's always good to have a chance to catch up with him. Peter Husey, welcome back. Good to have you.
No, thank you, Frank. It's very nice to talk with you this morning.
Let me ask you, Peter, you talked in a recent piece in the Daily Caller about something that has largely gone unremarked, I'm sorry to say, in all of the thrashing around about Iran. The murderous attacks that the Iranians have engaged in against Americans now for decades seems to go, as I say, mostly unnoted. Give us a sense of the magnitude of what they've been up to and how it ought to inform our thinking about this nation that has, after all, had as its motto since the founding of the Islamic Republic under Ayatollah Khomeini, death to America.
Right. Well, they've really carried it out. Since 1979 through the 9/11 attacks, they killed 3,600 Americans. And then since then, they've killed another 500 Americans, according to the Pentagon, with IEDs in Iraq.
Those are improvised explosive devices.
It's terrible. So, I mean, when you add it all up, it's over 4,000 Americans are dead at the hands of the mullahs in Iran. And my question is, not only should Americans not have anything to do with these people in terms of trade and investment and so forth, but what the heck are the Europeans and doing? I understand the Chinese and Russians who don't care, but certainly our European allies should just turn these guys off. And we've been making considerable progress in that area.
But they're still beavering away at trying to help prop up the regime, unfortunately. And Peter, one of the things that you note, the bulk of those losses, of course, was in connection with the attacks of 9/11. Very few people know, it seems, even now, that the Iranians were complicit in that, along with, obviously, Saudis. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I think the evidence is that the country involved was Iran, and then there might have been, you know, rich sheikhs in other parts of the Gulf, as Massoud, the head of the Northern Alliance, pointed out. But what I find interesting is the 9/11 Commission said that the Iranians trained the hijackers with Hezbollah in order to how to take over airplanes, you know, the musclemen. And when you look at the previous attacks on Khobar Towers, the attacks in Lebanon at our Marine barracks and our embassy, it's all car bombs blowing up or bombs of one kind or another, except for 9/11, of course, the bomb was the airplane. And what I find interesting is that people don't even mention that Iran has been at war with us since 1979 and has killed, when you look at the 4,000 people they've killed, that's versus the 7,000 American soldiers that have died in Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout what was misnomed global war on terror since 9/11. So anybody who's killed 4,000 and then another 7,000 have died, that's a lot of people. And their death to America, obviously they're carrying it out.
They mean it. Peter, let me turn to another topic. You've been studying and helping, as I say, the rest of us think more seriously about nuclear issues for quite some time. I wanted to ask you about this exercise that is underway, I believe, as we speak, or will be shortly, between the Russians and the Chinese, called Vostok 18. Tell us about both the size and the implications of this exercise.
This was the largest exercise since the Cold War, and I think the largest joint Russian-Chinese exercise ever. And what I find fascinating, and I was on ABC's John Batzer show Wednesday, and what we talked about was that the Chinese have adopted, as Putin did in April of 2000, use nuclear weapons early and often, the way Mayor Daley talked about voting in Chicago. And that is in a crisis, threatened early to get the United States to back down. And the unmistakable character of these exercises was exactly that. So China has adopted the early use of nuclear weapons, or the threatened early use of nuclear weapons in a crisis, as a getting away for the United States to back down or coerce us. And as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said just recently at a conference in, I think it was in Alabama, he said, these guys are in the business of defeating our forces, not just deterring. It's not just spheres of influence. It's actually pushing us away from like the west of the entire Pacific. And this has enormous implications economically as well as from a security point of view.
Sure. Peter, when you look at this exercise, as I understand it, it appeared to have as one of its targets Taiwan, as well as perhaps, as you say, our forces or perhaps even our homeland with nuclear attacks. Tell us a little bit about the state of affairs as you see it with Taiwan. I've had guests tell me that the Chinese have been planning to be able to attack and take over the place forcibly by 2020. Is that your understanding?
My understanding, if you read Mike Pillsbury's book and work by Bill Gertz and others, is that they want to push our ability to come to the defense of Taiwan from within range to all the way back to San Francisco, so to speak. And that is part of this island chain thing they're building in the South China Sea, which basically mirrors what the Japanese did building up to World War II. So this is serious stuff. It's not just, oh, they claimed a few islands and it's a matter of, you know, they'd like extra territory. They put nuclear-armed bombers on these island chains in the South China Sea recently, and they really want to take over Taiwan. They want to push us out of Korea, and they want to dismember our alliance with Japan.
Yeah, serious stuff indeed. Speaking of Korea, Peter, you've spent a lot of time in the country and also been studying what's going on there. Obviously, there's been some deflation, shall we say, of the high hopes that President Trump, I think, and others had about negotiated denuclearization of North Korea. Would you talk a little bit about something else that's very worrying, Peter, and that is the emerging and seemingly ever more aggressive policy of South Korea to, well, perhaps even unify the country on terms that would be pretty consistent with the North Koreans' demands?
Yes, it's something that all the way back in the early 2000 period when Kim Dae-jung was president of the country, they put a lot of money, government money, into think tanks that basically parroted it's hard to believe, the North Korean line, which was America was the bad guy. If we left, tensions would reduce. All we have to do is declare peace and la-da-da-da. And as you know, this the current president, Moon, of South Korea, was the architect of what it was called the Sunshine Policy with the North, which obviously didn't work. But what I see is the South Korean rhetoric and the South Korean wishful thinking is way, way ahead of the security situation, as you just said. And I think that believe it or not, the Korean people are going to rein President Moon back in, because he's so far out in front in terms of thinking that the North has not delivered. And when the North has not delivered, except for the moratorium on missile tests, the moratorium on nuclear tests are a good thing. But be that it as may, the North has not seriously taken a step onto that bridge called denuclearization.
Peter, thank you so much for your time today. Have a great holiday weekend, and we'll talk with you on the other side. Next up, we'll speak with Ryan Morrow right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Ryan Morrow. He is a national security analyst for the Clarion Project and one of the country's duty experts on the threat of jihadism, if you will, or Sharia supremacism, as I tend to call it, here inside the United States. Ryan has been doing really pioneering work for a long time, especially about the presence of infrastructures that are used by these Sharia supremacists, both to train and potentially to engage in violent attacks against the rest of us. And it's always a treat to catch up with them. It's been far too long. Ryan Morrow, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Well, you have been following particularly closely, Ryan, the saga still, I guess, unfolding of this terrorist camp run by a man by the name of Siraj Wahaj. I guess we would call him Junior, the son of a prominent Sharia supremacist of the same name in New York, that was seemingly both training young children for jihad and simultaneously, inexplicably, starving them. Tell us what this was all about, Ryan, and how serious a problem you think it represented prior to it fortunately being busted up.
I frankly think that we barely missed a major attack. It's clear to me that if they were planning to carry out school shootings while the school year was ready to begin, it seemed like something was imminent. And when the state and local authorities went in, because the FBI kept saying that there was a lack of probable cause in order to raid this compound on the New Mexico-Colorado border, that it's really just a miracle that there wasn't a shootout, because these were jihadists that sought death, craved death, prepared for a shootout and to die in that situation. And I still don't quite understand how a shootout did not happen. It just doesn't make sense. But this is a terrifying series of events that has happened, not just with the construction of the compound, but with the broader implication here, because of every single one of the adults there, and actually every single one of the kids there, is a relative of Imam Siraj Wahaj, a radical imam in Brooklyn who some describe as one of the grandfathers of the Muslim American community in the United States. He's not a fringe character. He's one of the top leaders. And we don't have evidence that he ran this compound operation at this point, because there are serious ideological differences, because this group kind of went into the deep end of the jihadist deep end in terms of believing in cultish type things. But you have to ask, where did they get these original ideas from? Where did they get the skills from? And Imam Siraj Wahaj's network would provide that.
Yeah. He is featured prominently, Siraj Wahaj Sr., as you know, in fundraisers and tub-thumping exercises of the Sharia supremacists around the country. He was credited with playing a constructive role in unraveling this situation. Is that credible, as you see it, that he ratted out his son when he learned that bad things were being done to his grandchildren?
I think it just came down to that his son was a fugitive and his son abducted his grandson. And so, yes, he probably did call the police after the mother of that child, who later passed away from being denied medication. After the mother called the police, I'm sure Imam Wahaj talked to the police. It's very possible for someone to be a jihadist and then say, well, my relative is doing something bad and I care about my grandson. But that doesn't make him a moderate. And it doesn't mean that he provided something unique that would not have been acquired otherwise, because one of the compound leaders purchased a 10-acre plot of land and then built over it onto the neighbor's land. That's detectable. So I would not say at this point I'm convinced that Imam Wahaj did anything that we would say, well, he is the one responsible for thwarting these attacks.
Or that it in any way, shape, or form negates the very dangerous stuff he's doing in other respects. So against the backdrop of what you've described, something that seems just inexplicable is that somehow all of these folks seem to have gotten a get-out-of-jail-free card from a judge out in New Mexico. Tell us what happened.
Right. It's really shocking to see this. First, we had an insane ruling from a judge who I'm dubbing Judge Social Justice Warrior, because the ruling read like a social justice warrior protester, where she essentially said that they don't pose a direct threat to the community, and so they could get out on a signature bond and not even have to put money down and be out on house arrest. That's what caused the initial nationwide controversy. Then additional charges were filed, And now we just learned that another judge has dropped the child abuse charges, despite the fact that the kids were almost starving to death and on the cusp of death. And the reason is because of technicality. There was a procedural error in scheduling the preliminary hearing. So in that case, the judge may not have been wrong. That was just a ridiculous error on the part of the prosecutors. But it seems like every single week that goes by, there's another insane turn in the story.
So these guys are at large, is that right? And are they going to be reunited with these kids they've been abusing?
There are two of the five that are being held because of the additional charges, and three have been released. And so they are loose with every incentive in their jihadist mind to try to carry out an attack or flee because they don't want to be in jail the rest of their lives. And so it's a frightening situation. My sources say they're looking to imminently refile charges. But with the way this story has gone, who knows if that happens?
Yeah. And how about the kids? Are they going to be brought out of foster care and reattached to these people?
It does not look like it. I highly doubt that would happen. According to the house arrest regulations, if it comes to that, any visit would have to be supervised.
Good. And that brings me to the larger question, Ryan Morrow. You have, as I said, been tracking closely other compounds, some of them much more developed than this one, around the country, notably some associated with an outfit called Jamaat al-Fukra, Muslims of America, as I recall. Tell us about that group and what we know about its current status.
Yeah, this is another mind-blowing cult that where it is just so hard to believe it exists in today's day and age. But since the 80s, there has been this relatively popular movement within the African-American Muslim community to establish isolated communes where radicals buy up a plot of land. They say that American society is decadent and you must protect yourself from it. And so all the radicals end up in one spot. And there's numerous groups pursuing that strategy. The one that has been most successful is called Jamaat al-Fukra, a name that they don't use anymore because it's not the best name to have around after you carry out a series of bombings attributed to that name. And that's what happened in the late 80s and early 90s. So now they use the name Muslims of the Americas so that whenever you criticize them, what's it sound like you're saying? Oh, well, I dislike Muslims of America. And so it's playing the Islamophobia card. But they follow essentially a cult jihadist leader in Pakistan named Sheikh Jalani. And they believe that when he passes away, which could happen at any second, that his successor will be the one that leads the final grand jihad and creates essentially the apocalypse that results in the takeover of the world and the global institution of Sharia. So to me, it's not just a jihadist threat or a typical violent cult threat. This is a magnitude much worse because their ideology believes in this near-term explosion happening once that green light goes out.
Yeah. A couple of things about this outfit, Ryan, just to make sure I'm clear about it and our audience as well. As I recall, Sheikh Jalani was actually recorded essentially inciting his followers to engage in jihad and describing this array of camps around the country, and I think there were some 30 of them at one point at least, to think of themselves as state-of-the-art terrorism training centers. Is that correct?
Right. So there have been multiple videos now of members of this group engaging in paramilitary training. By the way, it's similar to the paramilitary training that Siraj Wahaj's network is known for engaging in. They just do it a bit more pragmatically and covertly, and they know how to play the media game better.
And when you say Siraj Wahaj, you're talking about Siraj Wahaj Sr.?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I would go so far as to accuse him of being essentially a paramilitary leader because of what's come out of his mosque and the coalition that he leads. So you see a lot of commonalities here. Yeah, and there are some threads I'm following that may connect this Fukra group to the compound in New Mexico, although we can't 100% confirm it just yet.
Well, we want you to come back and tell us once you've got that sorted out. One other thing, as I understand it, there is a certain pattern to the population of these Jamaat al-Fukra or Muslims of America camps that has former felons, some of whom may have been converted to jihadism in jail, being brought into these kind of halfway houses. Is that correct as well, Ryan Morrow?
Yes, that is one of the patterns. The leaders are largely prison converts, and most of the people do have robust criminal records, and that's how they learn a lot of the skills that are necessary for the huge amounts of criminal activity that come out of the compounds. And the other pattern is an emphasis not just on training themselves, but acting as a conduit to other jihadist groups, including in training. So what's unique about Fukra is that, according to their ideology, they don't take credit for what they do. They're supposed to play a supporting role, and that actually gives them a greater ability to cooperate with others and to be more effective.
Yeah. Well, I commend folks. Ryan Morrow, one of the guys that we've long regarded as a go-to intelligence analyst on matters like the threats domestically to the United States from these Sharia supremacists. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Ryan, in the meantime, have a great holiday weekend, and thanks for the work you do with the Clarion Project. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll talk with you soon. Bill Gertz joins us next. We'll go inside the ring to talk about China, influence operations, espionage, and more right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for the tour that we get each week inside the ring from the author of a prize-winning column by that name, Bill Gertz. He writes it at the Washington Times. He is also the senior editor of the highly regarded and extremely valuable Washington Free Beacon. Bill is the author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
So, as ever, there is a lot that you've been covering lately. Much of it has to do with one aspect or another of what the Chinese are up to. And I'll be speaking to our next guest, David Goldman, about some of this as well. But let me walk through a couple of things that are top of mind as a result of some of your recent reporting, Bill. Tell us about the United Front Work Department in Communist China, with its some tens of thousands of operatives. What does it do, and how is it manifesting itself in operations here?
Yeah, this is a very important story I did for the Free Beacon this week, and it was based on a report that was done by the U.S. China Economic Security Review Commission, the Congressional Commission, and it was a staff report which looked at the activities of this Communist Party entity known as the United Front Work Department, which is a quasi-intelligence but also a very powerful influence organization directly under the tutelage of the Chinese Supreme Leader Xi Jinping. This report outlines how the United Front Work Department is literally buying up people and institutions. It's funding, the big takeaway from the report was that they were funding a number of major think tanks, including the Johns Hopkins SAIS Institute, as well as a number of others who are cooperating with this United Front Work Department. And the report recommends that, hey, we've got to stop this. I mean, with all the hysteria over Russian influence operations, we need to really focus much more on what the Chinese are doing in the influence sphere.
We do indeed. And, you know, think tanks in Washington, D.C. is pretty near to home for those of us at the Center for Security Policy. And I think your exposing of this is really important, Bill. But the sheer magnitude of the effort cannot be overstated. Let me ask you about something else, Bill. It got a little bit of attention, and then it seems to largely have disappeared. I suppose that has something to do with the fact that it involves a prominent Democratic politician, namely Senator Dianne Feinstein. But we've learned lately that her office, and she is again, of course, folks, the longtime senior member, partly the chairman, now the ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, had on her staff, as both one of her employees in her office out in San Francisco and as her driver when she was in Northern California, a communist Chinese spy. Bill, give us a sense of the magnitude of the problem that that probably represents.
Yeah, this is a really good story in the sense that it helps expose Chinese intelligence operations, traditional intelligence, which is to basically recruit people close to or with access to American secrets. And in this case, Feinstein, who is running for re-election and is facing a leftward challenge from the Democrats there, revealed that one of her staffers, a guy named Russell Lowe, who was the liaison to the Chinese American community in the San Francisco area, had been targeted for recruitment by the Chinese. Now, according to Feinstein, and she issued a very terse statement saying that there were no secrets compromised. Well, a member of Congress doesn't believe that. Representative Jim Banks, who's on the Armed Services Committee, has written to the FBI director asking for information about this case and really trying to get some details. Representative Banks wants a briefing on the nature of this case, how extensive it was. And his point was that people who have access to the secrets that Senator Feinstein had, which are, again, as the she was recently the chairwoman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and as in that position had access to all of the most important secrets within the U.S. intelligence community. So this is clearly a ongoing issue. The question is, did the Chinese Ministry of State Security successfully recruit this person? What information did they glean? Did they get? Were they able to influence her policies towards China, which we know her husband has a strong interest in China, has made lots of money in China. And so you have a question of both security as well as the influence operations.
Yeah. And Bill, you know, one of the things that I've thought about a lot, as I assume you have, in connection with Hillary Clinton's emails, which it turns out the Chinese were vacuuming up in real time, as well as this story, is, and for that matter, the House IT scandal, the kinds of information that people who have access even to personal correspondence or communications, phone calls, what have you, can nonetheless glean sensitive insights into what is going on, or have access to information that could be used to compromise, even blackmail, the principals involved. And this is something that, again, it seems to me our lack of national security mindedness in this country is really blinding us to as a significant problem. And Bill, I also wanted to ask you about one other thing, Taiwan. We're going to talk about it with David Goldman momentarily, but I'd like to just get your take on this. You talk about how some of these same influence operations of the United Front Work Department in China are being employed together with the triad gangs against Taiwan. What's up with all of that?
Yeah, this was also contained in the commission report on the United Front Work Department, and it identified several of triad-connected politicians in Taiwan who are openly voicing mainland positions. In other words, they're running interference for the Chinese government in meddling in the politics of Taiwan to try to influence there. It talked about the triads seeking to foment unrest and that this could be used as a pretext for a military attack on Taiwan in the future if they were to be able to bring about widespread social instability. The Chinese could use that as a pretext to try and forcibly reunite the island with the mainland, and which, of course, would also bring the U.S. military involved. So this is a pretty serious thing.
It is. It remains to be seen, of course, whether the U.S. military will be essentially kept out of the area by some of the capabilities that the Chinese are putting into place. Again, we'll talk more about that with David momentarily. Bill, two other things I wanted to just hit you on were the prospect of more security clearances being revoked after President Trump decided that John Brennan no longer needed to have one or was qualified to do so. What are you hearing on that score, Bill?
Yeah, the White House is actively working to do another round of security clearance revocations. They've formed kind of a working group within the White House, and they're expected to announce some additional clearance revocations in the very near future. Among those being targeted by the White House are Comey, the former FBI director, Andrew McCabe, the deputy FBI director. Both of them were fired by Trump for malfeasance related to various activities. Others facing revocation include fired FBI agent Peter Strzok and former FBI lawyer Lisa Page, as well as Bruce Ohr, who is the current Justice Department official who was involved in bringing in information from the questionable Christopher Steele, former British intelligence dossier, anti-Trump dossier.
Yeah. This is a real rogues gallery, and it certainly seems to me that the people who've currently got those clearances on that list have lacked the judgment, as presumably well as the need to know, to continue to enjoy access to state secrets. Bill, lastly, very quickly, your colleague at the Washington Free Beacon, Susan Crabtree, has a piece today about the sonic attacks on U.S. diplomats, notably in Cuba, but I believe also in China. Do you have an update for us on what's happening with all of that?
Well, it's kind of a mysterious, threatening action that's being taken by these governments. At this point, it's a little bit unclear. They haven't really revealed what the source is. The most important theory is that this is part of some type of electronic intelligence gathering operation that's causing this sonic efforts to cause brain injuries to American diplomats. It's a very serious issue, and hopefully the Trump administration will take it seriously.
Well, I hope so, too. Bill, one other thing we discussed with Peter Husey earlier in the program is the so-called Vostok 18 exercises, strategic exercises apparently simulating nuclear use involving collaboration between the Russians and the Chinese. What is the latest on that, and how is the Pentagon perceiving the strategic cooperation between these two hostile powers at the moment?
Yeah, this is a real alarming situation. This is some of the largest war games held by the Russians since 1982. And they're, for the first time, they're involving Chinese military forces. Vostok 18 is called East 18. And this is the showcase held every 4 years, which the Russians are conducting what they call the escalate to de-escalate practice. And this, again, is the nuclear doctrine that says you quickly use nuclear weapons early in a conflict. And, of course, this has really set off alarm bells within the Pentagon because of concerns about any kind of shootout or dust-up with the Russians could quickly become a major large-scale nuclear conflict. And, again, this is practice. These exercises, are the Russians are using them to practice, and now they're practicing with the Chinese, which is going to give them valuable insights into this notion of escalate to de-escalate nuclear warfare.
Bill Gertz, as always, your insights on these matters is incredibly valuable. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us again next week. David Goldman joins us next, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being just about every week, by David Goldman, one of the smartest guys I know, certainly in terms of the nexus between economics and foreign policy, national security more generally. He writes under the pseudonym of Spengler at Asia Times. He is the author of How Civilizations Die, and he is a great friend and resource, and we're very appreciative of his time. David, thank you for joining us again.
Oh, it's a privilege, Frank. Thanks for the kind words.
So, David, there's a lot to talk about in particular in Asia at the moment, and I want to work through sort of a checklist with you, if I could, quickly. The Chinese currency seems to be holding fairly strong at the moment, though President Trump continues to ratchet up the pressure with respect to tariffs. There's talk of another $200 billion being imposed on the Chinese. Give us your current reading on how this is playing out and your forecast, if you would.
Even if you assume that China's entire trade deficit with the United States, as our trade deficit with China would be wiped out, China's imports would be reduced to zero by on that $200 billion worth of goods. In terms of value added, that amounts to a bit less than 1% of China's gross domestic product. So most of the analysts who crunch the Chinese numbers think that the effect on Chinese growth would be half to 1%, worst case scenario. They're growing at 6.5% a year. The last numbers we had overnight from Chinese manufacturing and services still show steady as she goes growth. So I don't believe that tariffs are a devastating blow to China at all. I think they're an annoyance. And in my view, if you're hunting bears, you want to shoot the bear, not annoy it. And the problem with tariffs is that they don't hurt China enough to accomplish our objectives.
Mm-hmm. How would you characterize our objectives as you understand them?
Our objective is to be the dominant military and economic power in the world indefinitely and not let China challenge us for that position. And China is challenging us. So the administration is very wise to call attention to that risk and to say that we don't find it acceptable for China to leapfrog us as a dominant military and economic power. It's simply that the mechanisms which they've used, the tools they've brought to the fight, in my view, are simply inadequate to that task. That's what worries me.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the stakes that might be involved in this contest, if you will. There is talk, we've spoken about it earlier in the program, of China moving inexorably forward on its stated objective, as I understand it, of retaking Taiwan by force if necessary, perhaps as early as 2020, according to former Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, Ace Lyons, yesterday. What's your reading on what's happening between China and Taiwan at the moment? Is there a more imminent crisis at hand, David Goldman?
China is doing everything possible to demonstrate its capability to take Taiwan back anytime it wants. So that includes a complex of military technologies. One is the acquisition of the Russian S-400 system, which has the range to effectively sweep the skies over Taiwan.
From the Chinese mainland.
From the mainland. They've got a 400-kilometer range, so they can shoot down anything that flies over the island. Another is the deployment of between 50 and 60 silent attack submarines, which potentially could sink American aircraft carriers or other vessels. There's, of course, a very large surface-to-ship missile capability, as well as enhanced air force and amphibious marine capability and so forth.
And anti-carrier ballistic missiles, too, lest we forget.
Exactly. So they've developed a whole range of technologies. They also have a vast network of observation balloons, which could do the same job as satellites in the South China Sea, for example, in a war situation where each side took out the other satellites. They'd still have very effective communications in the region. We would not, as far as I know. They'd have better communications. So I certainly hope it doesn't come to a war. I think what the Chinese want to do is to show what their capabilities are, intimidate us, intimidate the Taiwanese, and keep their options open to put pressure on us in a number of situations. Whether they actually plan to invade Taiwan in 2020, I really doubt, because the typical Chinese way of doing things is to try to win their objective without actually firing a shot.
Yeah, well, it goes back to Sun Tzu, doesn't it? Speaking of Chinese ambitions, I'm being told, David Goldman, and I don't know if you can confirm this or not, or simply whether it fits the profile, that the Chinese are building a base in Afghanistan, presumably from which they can more effectively seek to exploit the natural resources of that country, which are quite considerable, as well as project power in our stead. Your thoughts on that?
Chinese are very active in Afghanistan. Whether they're building a base or not, I can't confirm, but they are building bases in a number of places, including in the Horn of Africa, in Djibouti. This is very uncharacteristic of the Chinese. They've tended to be a continental power with very limited deployment outside of their own borders. I think the Chinese are opportunistically looking for places where they can gain footholds and see what they can do to make life difficult for us in the future. China is trying to understand exactly what the United States wants. Trump administration has said, for example, that it wants China to stop subsidizing its industries. Well, it's a state-run economy. That's what it does. It's not going to change its spots. It's not going to change into a different kind of economy. And the Chinese attitude is, well, if that's what they want, they're basically telling us to shut down, in which case we'll see what kind of misery we can create for the United States everywhere else in the world. And they're keeping their options open. I don't think they have a comprehensive plan at this point. The world has changed with Donald J. Trump. They're trying to understand how it's changed, and they're developing options.
Yeah. Options and capabilities, as you say, not least of which, and we discussed this at some length with Admiral Lyons yesterday, David Goldman, was this positioning of their power projection capabilities, as you say, both in Djibouti and in Pakistan, with the ability to control the flow of oil, perhaps out of the Persian Gulf and into the Red Sea and so on, as well as some of these similar kinds of colonial operations in Africa and the Caribbean, Latin America, and beyond. Let me ask you about one other thing. When we have you with us, David, I'm always anxious to get an update with you on another, not unrelated topic. We're talking about Chinese opportunism. You've pointed out that that's almost certainly in play in Turkey. Give us your current reading on how things are going for the Turks at the moment.
Well, Turkey is a typical third world kleptocracy, which ran itself into impossible amounts of debt and faces a currency meltdown as a result. The question is, who will bail them out or at least give them working capital to tie them over in the crisis? And the Chinese press has been saying, what a wonderful opportunity for our One Belt, One Road program. Make Turkey the terminus of the road, make them dependent on us, have them sell major assets such as their ports and other infrastructure to China. So they're certainly looking for a chance to buy Turkey on the cheap and effectively make it the westernmost province of the Chinese economy. So that's certainly a risk.
And in the immediate term, is the Turkish currency continuing its free fall and creating the opportunities for the Chinese to do just what you've described?
Turkish currency was trading around 3 to the dollar a year ago. Now it's trading around 6.5 to the dollar, so worth less than half of what it was. The Turks have tried various measures to stabilize the currency. They've only had temporary effect. So we're still very close to the all-time lows. And unless they do something quite effective, I think they're going to have to sustain a major recession before this is over. The currency will continue to weaken. So exactly at what point the Chinese decide it's cheap enough, you have to ask them. It's a negotiation.
Thank you very much, David, for your time today, as always, as well as your terrific contributions to the public policy debate at Asia Times and elsewhere. It's always good to talk with you. I hope you have a great Labor Day weekend. Come back to us after. Hope the rest of you will do the same next week. We'll be talking with you then. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.